When we last left our heroes, all seemed bleak. Moses, Aaron, and the elders of Israel had gone on strike and demanded of Pharaoh that he let the people go worship in the wilderness. That didn't work out very well, and Pharaoh just put them all to work making bricks without straw. This week we will be studying Exodus chapter 6, verse 28 through chapter 7, verse 13. In this section, we will see Moses and Aaron return to Pharaoh to perform a miraculous sign, but we will see Pharaoh's heart harden. It will be an excellent opportunity for us to discuss the nature of belief and evidence for belief. We'll also get to talk about magic, both the entertaining illusions and demonic practices. As usual, if you haven't read the passage already, now is a great time to pause and read Exodus chapter 6, verse 28, through chapter 7, verse 13. Coming out of our genealogy in Exodus chapter 6, God speaks to Moses again, telling him to go again to Pharaoh. Moses declares, as before, that he is incapable of doing so due to his speech impediment. He refers to this impediment by saying that he has uncircumcised lips. While some guess that this is Moses' way of being humble, declaring a lack of holiness befitting a spokesman of God, or perhaps even his way of saying that he is himself uncircumcised, it appears to me that he is simply using a rather crass Hebrew idiom, which simply means that he is a bad talker. You can imagine that a person with a foreskin around his mouth would have difficulty getting any words out clearly. At this, moving to chapter 7, Jehovah reiterates to Moses that Aaron will speak for him. As God delivers a message to a prophet, so shall Moses do for Aaron, and Aaron will be the mouthpiece. As God has said before, he continues to insist that he will do signs and wonders in Egypt, that Pharaoh will not listen, and that the people will be delivered from their bondage regardless. Verse 7 notes that Moses was 80 years old at the time, and Aaron was 83. Some of you listening to me might be in your later years. Know that those are not certain to be years in which you must simply wait for death. They could be years of great use to the kingdom, if you use them wisely. Now, when Moses and Aaron go back to Pharaoh, God gives them an explicit command to perform the miracle of turning a staff into a snake. So Aaron finally performs the sign which we expected him to have performed the first time. He throws down the staff, and it becomes a snake. Well, probably becomes a snake. The language is actually not totally clear. It could possibly have been a lizard. Some even say it was a crocodile. Regardless, a snake makes the most sense to me. A staff looks a little like a snake in the first place. So we'll go with that. In verse 11, Pharaoh's magicians are able to duplicate the trick. So what's going on here? I thought that Aaron had a special miracle to perform. Well, first off, in examining this, let's note that Aaron has performed a real miracle. Aaron, we are told in verse 10, cast the staff down in front of Pharaoh and his servants. You will note that he cast the staff down. He was not holding it or manipulating it. He also cast it down in front of everyone, so that they could watch the transformation. He did not have control of this environment. He couldn't have had an assistant opening a trap door in the floor. He couldn't have manipulated the lights or made a smoke screen to hide from everyone. Aaron threw the staff down and did nothing to it, while God turned it into a snake. You know, I've been searching the internet looking for a video of someone performing a trick like this, and I can't find anything like it. I've found some pretty obvious sleight of hand things that use props that turn into toy snakes. I've seen people put a toy snake into a hat where we can't see it and then pull out a live snake. I can't find anything like what Aaron did. Evidently, the finest modern illusionists can't match the feat today. So if you find someone who comes up with a convincing way to do a similar trick, I'd really love to see it. That would be a lot of fun for me. We have a question, though, which is, if Pharaoh's magicians didn't have God's help to perform a miracle, how did they do the trick? Well, before we get to that, let's examine just who these magicians that Pharaoh called out are. The King James and ESV are both in agreement in calling these men wise men, sorcerers, and magicians in the different words that speak of them. These men were likely the priests of Pharaoh's polytheistic cult. The words, translated magician and sorcerer, specifically inform us that these men were involved in occult practices and witchcraft, and the word wise men informs us that these men were the learned scholars of this false religion. So they weren't just Pharaoh's entertainers who professed to engage in illusions and sleight of hand. They claimed to have a power from their false gods, a power which we recognize could only be demonic. So seeing that they are the priests of a false religion, is it possible that they have genuinely tapped into some demonic power to change a staff into a serpent? Well, first, we believe absolutely that the Bible is correct in saying that there are demons and that there are demonic forces at work in the world. Second, we should note plainly that the scriptures consistently and repeatedly condemn any attempts to make use of those demonic forces for any purpose. When we get to the law, we're going to see that there are many occult practices that are plainly outlawed. Deuteronomy 18:10-11 contains a lengthy list of these practices, including fortune-telling, interpreting signs, sorcery, necromancy, and so forth. So there are demonic practices, and those demonic practices are strictly forbidden. However, there still remains some question as to whether or not these practices can actually work for any kind of benefit. Aside from this instance of the magicians turning a staff into a snake, I can think of only one other occult practice having an appearance of being effective in the Bible, and that is the story of Saul visiting the spiritual medium for guidance. That, incidentally, is said to be the sin over which God killed him. You find that in 1 Chronicles chapter 10, verses 13 through 14. That incident with Saul is a confusing one. You can find the full story in 1 Samuel chapter 28, and in it, Saul visits a witch and asks her to raise Samuel from the dead so that he can speak to him. There is considerable debate about whether the witch tricked Saul into thinking that she had summoned Samuel's ghost from the dead, or whether she was possessed by a demon whom she thought was Samuel's ghost, or whether she actually brought Samuel back by a demonic power, or whether God brought Samuel back in spite of her attempts to use demonic power. The point is that we don't have any clear guidance elsewhere in the scriptures that any demonic arts can actually be used to accomplish anything that they claim to accomplish. Whether or not these demonic practices can be effective, it is obvious that these demons exist and that attempts to make use of their power is only likely to harm the person who attempts to do so. And for that reason, and because it is strictly prohibited, I will give you my strongest warning not to engage in such activities. And you can be sure that demonic activities are very common in our culture. There are fortune tellers and palm readers who make plenty of money off of their scams. You'll hear spiritists pop up on the radio, and you'll find astrological predictions in the local newspaper. Stupid teenagers still pull out a Ouija board and attempt to contact the dead. False religions like Hinduism and Islam engage in the worship of their false demonic gods all the time. We've actually got cities right here in the United States that are erecting monuments to Satan in an effort to be religiously neutral, and even Wicca is seeing a resurgence. So these cultic practices are growing in popularity, and I want to ensure that no one in our church is having any involvement in them, no matter how common they become. These are demonic practices which are strictly forbidden by the Bible, and which cannot be expected to produce the desired outcome. Almost certainly, they will have a disastrous result, so stay away from them. But the question remains as to whether or not these magicians were able to make a staff turn into a snake by a demonic power. Now, I won't go so far as to say that it is impossible, but I will say that there is a much more likely solution. The ESV and NIV tell us that the magicians made their staves into snakes by their, quote, secret arts. The King James translation has it that they did this by, quote, enchantments. Now, those words sound like some kind of dark demonic magic, but I decided to dig a little deeper into the Hebrew. The word translated secret arts or enchantments is from the Hebrew word lahet. This word comes from the word for a flame. By extension, it describes something that flashes with light, like a sword, and also something that is engulfed in flame and thus hidden from view. From there, the word takes on its cultic meaning, referring to those things which are hidden, secretive, and associated with magical arts. Now, when we see the path that the word takes to get around to metaphorically describing some dark cultic magic, we understand that it might also be more literally describing someone actually hiding a thing. Particularly, this might have been a trick which was literally obscured from view by smoke, fire, or some other flash of light. The point then is this. We can very easily understand from the language of this passage that the magicians did not use some magical secret art, but rather that they literally performed the transformation in secret. So here's how they might have done it in keeping with the passage. They hold up a stick for everyone to see and then throw it on the ground. While the stick is on the ground, they take some concealing barrier, like a blanket, which already had a snake hidden inside. They throw the blanket over the staff in such a way that the snake lands next to it, and when the blanket is removed, they pick up the staff with it while drawing attention to the snake still sitting on the floor. In that way, from the perspective of the viewer, the staff had been thrown down and became a snake by a secret art. Well, I think a child could see through that trick, and as a matter of fact, I know that a child could see through it, because I've done it for small children, and they didn't fall for it. Now, I will admit that I am no expert in sleight-of-hand tricks, but in preparation for this sermon, I performed this trick for a live audience of several small children aged 5 and under. And I did it to the best of my ability. I didn't have a live snake, of course, so a rubber snake had to do, but I'll tell you something, the kids saw straight through it. I think I tricked a 3-year-old for a few minutes until the 5-year-old explained it, but if a group of toddlers can figure this trick out, then Pharaoh, the ruler of Egypt, was surely smart enough to understand how it worked. And I'll tell you something else. If what I've described is the correct meaning of the passage, then the trick the magicians did is different from what Aaron did. The passage tells us clearly that Aaron threw his staff down right there, quote, in front of Pharaoh, not concealed behind a barrier, not with a distracting flash of light, not with a puff of smoke, not in a hidden, secretive way. He threw it down in front of God and everybody, and it became a snake. That's a trick I'd like to see. This incident, if you want my opinion, is a very clear display of Pharaoh's lack of belief that is built in to an unwillingness to believe. Pharaoh is biased. Moses and Aaron show him a miracle. He knows it's a miracle. But he calls in his boys to see if they can do the same thing. Why? Why does he call them in? Might it not be that he just wants any excuse not to believe Moses and Aaron? Well, here come the magicians to placate him, and they perform a hokey parlor trick like a magic show that a 12-year-old does in the living room. And Pharaoh has got what he's looking for. He rejects the genuine evidence in favor of the hoax, and he knows full well what he is accepting is a sham. But he does it anyway because he would prefer not to know the truth. Well, even if Pharaoh didn't want to see through the magician's ruse, he should have. And even after the magicians have come up with their version of Aaron's trick, Aaron's snake proves to be the better one by eating up the other snakes. And let's bear in mind, there are at least 2 other snakes, so Aaron's snake has a lot of fighting and eating to do here. Does Pharaoh want to accept that? Nope. Nothing convinces Pharaoh because he doesn't want to be convinced. There are a lot of people like this in the world today. People say it to me all the time. Oh, so you believe the Bible? Well, prove to me that it is true. In the first place, I think that's a pretty silly thing to say. The Bible is a historical document and is, hands down, the best attested document from ancient history. I never hear people saying, oh yeah? Prove to me that Julius Caesar was assassinated. Well, I don't feel any need to prove that. We have a historical record. As a general rule, we trust the historical record unless we have a pretty compelling reason not to trust it. Otherwise, we'd have to start questioning whether or not any historical event happened. People will answer, well, you have to prove that the Bible is true because it seems pretty unreasonable that all those miraculous things happened. But is it unreasonable that miraculous things happened? I mean, if there is a God, then we should believe that he can do some pretty incredible things, and we should expect that at some point in history he would. So why are miraculous interjections from God somehow unbelievable? Why do they require any more proof than any other historical event might need? You see, the only reason that the atheist demands proof of the truth of the Bible is because he has presupposed that there is no God. And, believing that there is no God, the atheist insists that the Bible cannot be reasonable, and therefore it must be proven. That logic doesn't follow, however. And I've got news for you. If the Bible isn't true, Mr. Atheist, the burden falls on the unbeliever to disprove it. Because guess what? The Bible has been around for thousands of years. It is believed by billions of people all over the world, and it is believed by a majority of people in our society today. Now, having a majority of people who believe something doesn't make it true, but when does it ever fall on a majority of people to prove something that has the kind of staying power and influence that the Bible has? If I run into a group of atheists and say that the world is round, am I obligated to prove to them that it isn't flat just because a few of them might think so? The majority is never burdened to prove simple facts like the existence of God to a fringe minority. I don't have to prove that the sky is blue or that water turns to ice when it gets cold or that boys are boys and girls are girls. Atheists can deny simple facts all they want, but when they do, they are burdened to bring the proof to the table. But for a moment, let's play along. Next time an atheist demands that you prove to him that there is a God, you need to ask him a question. What kind of evidence will you accept? Because here's the big problem I run into when I have discussions with atheists. They're often just like Pharaoh. They aren't really looking for evidence, and no matter what evidence they get, they'll just throw it out and come up with any possible excuse not to believe it. The simple fact is that we can show evidence that supports the truth of the Bible enough that a reasonable person should believe it. But nothing can be proved beyond any possible doubt to a person who does not want to believe it and who will not accept the evidence. What do you think an atheist would say if you told him you had seen God with your own two eyes and talked to him yourself? He would say, "Nuh-uh, you're lying." Well, evidently eyewitness testimony wouldn't be good enough for him. There are millions and millions of people all over the world who claim to have experienced God's presence. And who is to say that we don't have a sense of God like we have a sense of balance and time? Well, that sense is not good enough for an atheist. What do you think an atheist would say if you showed him a photograph of God? He would say, "Nuh-uh, you made that in Photoshop." Yep, good one, atheist. Any documentary evidence, just like a historical record, could possibly have been altered. I guess you should throw out every book you own and every photo you've ever seen, because nothing is true for you except the fantasies of your own mind. What do you think an atheist would do if you brought God into his house and said, "Look, Mr. Atheist, here's God. He's going to perform some miracles for you now to prove it's him." Please. The minute God left, the atheist would say, "Nuh-uh. I was dreaming or hallucinating, or you drugged me, or you brought in a really good illusionist in here and he did some crazy stuff, but he can't be God." And guess what? God actually did show up one time. His name was Jesus, and he showed himself to thousands and thousands of people and performed miracles in their presence. And you know what? Some of them still wouldn't believe in him because they didn't want to. So what evidence will you accept? I get some funny answers to that question. I had a guy tell me once, "I'll believe that there is a God if you get him to fly down from the sky and land on the Capitol Dome in Washington, D.C., and start shooting fireballs out of his hands and saying, 'I am the God who created you.'" Seriously, a guy actually said that when I was talking about this with him. And he meant it. Now, I don't want to badmouth him because he was a friend of mine many years ago, but he's got a problem with that answer. In the first place, I don't think anyone should need evidence that specific to prove that there is a God, and I'm pretty sure he only used that as a standard because he knew that nothing that specific was ever going to happen. He was intentionally trying to ensure that nothing I could do would ever prove it to him. He was at least correct in presuming that I don't have the power to call God down and have him land on the Capitol Dome. But look at the error here. It's pride. This guy and lots of other atheists have an idea that God owes it to them to prove something. It's like they think they're the judge of the universe and God is in big trouble if he can't prove something to them by showing up and delivering the highest standard of proof that anyone can come up with. I've said it before and I'll say it again, folks. God doesn't owe us anything. If we want to believe in him, the evidence is there. But if you don't want to believe, no amount of evidence that I can show you will ever make any difference. And besides, even if that guy got footage of God throwing fireballs off the Capitol Dome, he'd say it was all computer-generated. And if he was in the crowd that saw it, he'd say that there was a mass delusion, chemicals dropped from airplanes or something to make people go crazy and see things. So here's another story about an atheist friend. I said, "What evidence will you accept to believe that Jesus rose from the dead?" He said, "I would accept written and signed documentation from multiple eyewitness sources who were willing to testify to it in court." Well, great. He's doing better than my friend with the fireballs. So here's what I told him. I said, "We've got the Bible. It was written by eyewitness sources. Paul wrote in Galatians 6:11 that he had signed it with his own hand. He and others also attested to the fact that hundreds had seen Jesus raised. Paul testified to it all in court and ended up in prison, where he and lots of other early Christians were willing to die for their testimony of having seen Jesus raised." I said, "Friend, you picked a great set of evidence there. It's about the best you could possibly ask for, and we've got everything you asked for right here." I said to him, "Will you believe it now?" And he said, "No." You see, atheists are always asking for evidence, but I've never met an atheist who had an evidence problem. You know, Jesus told a parable about a man who died and went to hell. While he was roasting in the flame, he had a conversation with Father Abraham, who was out of the fire on the other side of a chasm. The man begged Abraham to send someone back from the dead so that his brothers would believe and not end up in the flame. Abraham responded, saying, "If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced even if someone rises from the dead." And he was right. Moses provided enough evidence to Pharaoh, and the prophets who came after Moses provided enough evidence for the people in their time and the people in ours. The matter is settled. Even then, Jesus raised people from the dead, and Jesus himself rose from the dead, and still, there were and are people who do not believe him. So why won't some people believe? Well, we know that God hardens hearts. We've discussed that before. But to dig into the practical, tangible, immediate mechanics of it all, my experience is that most people who don't believe don't want to believe in God, and they don't want to believe in God or the Bible because they don't want to change their lifestyle. Believing in God means living the way that God wants you to live, or else. It means radically shifting everything that you do, and for some people that means they'll have to quit a job that they love. A job that maybe leads them into an immoral lifestyle but pays them very well. They'll miss that money if they change. They aren't willing to let it go. Some people don't want to get off drugs. Some people don't want to get out of destructive relationships. Some people are just too proud to admit something that they've mocked so many others for believing for so many years. But listen, change is what Jesus calls you to do. If he could give up his life for you, you can give up your life for him. Don't be too proud to change. There's no one here at East Jordan Church who will mock you for turning your back on the wrong ideology. So, today, Moses and Aaron have repeated their demands before Pharaoh, and Aaron has performed a miraculous sign. Pharaoh's heart remains hardened. Next week, the real excitement starts as the plagues of Egypt begin. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.